I'm really pleased to invite up our next panelist. Evan Moglen is going to come up and talk with us about the challenges of licensing in the Web 2.0 era, and particularly his thinking about how to address licensing for software as a service.
As long as it's okay to agree that I'm going to talk about licensing and I think the Web 2.0 era doesn't exist, sure. Nice to talk to you.
I'm perfectly happy to do that however you want to discuss it.
Great.
Okay. So start with that. So the Web 2.0 era doesn't exist.
No, that's just a bunch of hooey by self-promoters. The web is a data storage system, distributed and powerful because distributed, full of essentially crappy technology waiting to be replaced. But the revolution we've been through hasn't been the centralization of processing capacity, it's been the distribution of processing capacity. The idea that what actually happens is that all the data winds up in the hands of the world's greatest intellectual intelligence service, collecting everything that we all do and inferring from it for private profit, that's not on. There'll be a massive resistance to that sense of the greatest intelligence service and secret police force in the world as an ad broker within the next 10 years. People will say, no, we're going to store it ourselves. We have immense amounts of cheap storage. We've immense amounts of cheap processing power. We've wonderful software made for us by hundreds of thousands of people around the world just to share. We're going to store our own data and do what we want with it. And at that point, the cross-scripting security vulnerabilities of AJAX will suddenly make people as frightened of that technology as they rightly are of ActiveX, and the whole thing will fall back into being just one of those silly dreams that wasted a lot of money.
All right. Well, that's actually a provocative vision of Web 3.0. If you like, but where's it? Can you tell us where that's actually happening, other than in
no? But this is relentlessly short-term radar, Tim. You're talking about 6 months or a year. You're not talking about what the 10-year period is. On the 10-year time scale, this stuff is thermal noise.
Okay. I could make the case that on the 10-year time period, Linux is thermal noise.
You could, but you'd be wrong. You would have a great difficulty showing that. Pick any 10 years you want, and the line would still be rocketing deeply upward. You'd be looking at 4 or 5 orders of magnitude growth over any 10 years in its lifetime that you picked, right? So you couldn't do it.
All right. Let me just sort of ask you, though, about the idea that led me to, you're obviously pretty deeply skeptical of my premises, so that's good. But the personal computer was a radical democratization of the hardware that we use, with the introduction of fairly open standards. What happened when
some lawyers made some mistakes and a vast monopoly was created by accident. Destroying that monopoly was work that was failed at by the two largest governments on Earth, and the people in this room are doing it.
Okay, fair. But we went through from a period of opening the technology to somebody finding another way to close it down.
A licensing mistake.
It was a licensing mistake. But okay. Isn't there another licensing mistake that's happened here where, I see what I call Web 2.0 was looking at that pattern and saying, oh, it's happening again. Because in fact, here we have open source software, but what ended up being built on top of that was a set of new proprietary layers, right? And the fact is, whether you consider Google thermal noise or not, it happened.
I think that's the underlying mistake. I was reading you last week saying, gee, we're going to have to get back to thinking about what freedom means in this context. So if you hadn't taken this whole long 10-year wasted detour talking about open source instead of concentrating on concepts of freedom, we could have had the conversation you and I are about to have now 10 years ago when you started this whole long divagation, which is now coming to an end. So what we want to have is a philosophic discussion,
okay.
Spread this open source nonsense over to the edge, and saying now we're talking about what freedom means in this highly networked, still over-concentrated network that we have. We've made some significant progress at defeating a software ownership bottleneck in the course of which we have created some allies, very large, very powerful, very capable, far more committed to our point of view than the Microsoft monopolist would ever have been, but bringing with them now the enormous weight of all this money, which is corrupting in a whole variety of ways to the people who touch it, not surprisingly. We've now got to create for ourselves some diplomatic and ecological structures which will help us to maintain those alliances in good order. I don't actually think those structures are regulatory. I don't think they're based in the licenses. I think if we go back and look at what the concepts of freedom are, we've got to conclude that what Google does is absolutely what they have a right to do in freedom. They shouldn't need anybody's permission to run programs. Stallman was right about that at the very beginning. If you have to ask other people's permission to run a program, you don't have adequate freedom. And that means you've got to have the right to run a program for someone else, because that's a fundamental part of sharing. Moreover, you've got to have a right to make private modifications, because if you don't have a right to make private modifications and keep them to yourself whenever you want to, then the principle of freedom of thought is being rudely disrupted by a required responsibility to disclose what you are thinking to somebody with an order. And that's no more freedom than it is to say that we are required to produce our filing cabinets to the CIA or the Justice Department or Microsoft. So if we take the philosophical responsibilities to provide freedom seriously, we're going to have to say people have a right to run programs without any doubt. They have a right to run programs for other people and offer services for money without any doubt and without permission. And they have a right to make private modifications and keep them to themselves. So their rights, properly protected, may conflict with other people's rights, properly protected. The solution isn't to attempt to reduce anybody's rights. The solution is to engage in the mature kind of grown-up diplomacy that consists in telling people we can't regulate what we do, but we can agree voluntarily on what we do. Now, Google has few critics more firm than I, and I have had my share of complaining email from Chris DeBono about how I'm not backing the people who back me and all of that. But I will say at the same time that the complaining that I do is complaining about what could go wrong in the future.
Oh, I certainly agree that many things can go wrong. But tell us a little bit more about what are the rights. Okay, so you've established Google's right to do what they do, but what rights do they infringe of ours?
None, whatever. That's my point. I have said if they don't behave with adequate diplomatic tact and adequate ecological assurance, we will have problems down the road, and those will be very different, difficult problems to resolve, because they will be conflicts of rights problems.
Right. I'm still sort of curious, though. You came in and you said that Web 2.0 was a bunch of hooey, that the sort of the aggregation of power in vast centralized databases was just thermal noise. And so something is going to replace Google. What's going to be the driver of that, you know, decentralization?
The discovery that the ad broker business is not worth all the money that is presently being invested in it. The usual discovery that happens in finance capitalism when leverage suddenly turns out to be not as good an invention as it looked, and a whole bunch of people lose a lot of money, and hedge fund managers go back to driving slightly smaller SUVs, and everybody goes back to sweet reason. It'll happen in another few months, and we all see it. There's no confusion about this.
All right, so you're quite contrarian on that topic. I'm still struggling with the fact that you're arguing, you know, for decentralization. I'm a big believer in decentralization, and I look at, open source, which you don't like. I look at peer-to-peer. I look at distributed computation. I think these are all very interesting. But the existence proof right now is that on top of open source, on top of free software, are being built massive centralized systems.
You must be living in a different world than I am. Look around this room. Mm-hmm. We've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 supercomputers in this room, because we've got, 150, 200 machines that, when I started doing this work in 1979, cost $2 or $3 million each. We've got as much data storage capacity in this room right now as there was in the whole Santa Teresa laboratory that I went to work in July of 1979, plus the whole of the Watson Research Center. Right?
Yeah.
Right. We're not living in a world of centralization. We're living in a world in which we have decentralized the fundamental properties of data processing to the edge completely. We have afforded everybody in the room more opportunity to make software than the whole of the IBM Corporation had in 1965. That's decentralization.
That's right. And you're my watch has more processing power than the moon.
You're talking about is the tiniest, thinnest layer on top of that. The real underlying truth is we have spread computing power across 20% of humanity, and in another generation we'll have spread it across 100%. And at that point, the guys who are brokering classified advertisements or doing auctioneering are going to be the tiniest scratch on the surface of what software is actually doing and who is actually making it. You're spending 90% of your time worrying about 2% of the activity.
So your net is there's no problem because the world is going to keep progressing in this decentralized...
No, my net is that the problems are connected with principle and public policy. They're not connected with self-promotion and commercial activity. My net is if we had been worrying about issues of principle for the last 10 years, instead of vaporing about open source, we'd have done a whole lot of work then that we're going to have to do now. He's got $25 billion more than he had 10 years ago. Stallman and I were worried about him 10 years ago, and we knew what to do about it. You guys were wasting time talking about open source. We're still here. We still got most of that work to do. Still have the patent system to deal with. Still have serious problems of the distortion of the software market by a guy with $50 billion he shouldn't have. We've still got serious problems of correcting the public policy mistakes made by people who were propping up business models that were dying at the expense of the freedom to learn, the freedom to understand, and the freedom to share. Got heaps and heaps of work to do. That's basically political, public policy, diplomatic work. And you're wasting your time promoting commercial products. That's my take.
Okay. So let me ask you, though. Okay, so... what would you do differently?
I'd scrape the name off the thing. I'd put freedom up there. Uh-huh. And I'd talk about rights, which is what yourself are beginning to realize has been missing from the dialogue that you've been conducting.
I'll leave aside the personal attacks. Give us something
that
concrete.
That wasn't a personal attack, Tim. That was an invitation to do the thing that you two know is important, which is to stop worrying about the little stuff that's going to make a little money this year, a little bit of money next year, and start worrying about what the long-term public policy and philosophic consequences are of all this lovely technology we've spread around the world,
which
is either good for eradicating freedom or good for supporting freedom.
Okay, now, I want you to make some concrete suggestions for, say, a Google. What do they need to do differently?
If you go to Google Video and type my last name, you'll find an hour of me making concrete suggestions to Google about what they ought to do. But surely you would agree that even that is between us and Google, right? It's not the breakfast conversation here. That's a diplomatic question. It comes down to the ordinary give and take of diplomatic principles saying, this year we need this. This year we need that. Here's where we're going. Here's where we're going. Well, let's try and avoid stepping on one another's toes. It's real, ordinary, diplomatic business.
Okay, so thinking about Dave Moran's here from Facebook. What would you like Facebook to do?
Nothing whatever. Facebook is a question of what are kids doing this week. Next year they'll be doing something else.
Okay,
that's not my problem. Facebook has money, Facebook has lawyers, Facebook has customers. It will do what it does. Dave was perfectly clear. He's really the lamp stack. He's the lamp stack in business doing the thing the kids want done this week. I think, gee, that's wonderful. Great. Make $1 billion. But that doesn't present any issues for you and me. That's just a guy doing his business. Great. I wish him well.
So what does present issues for you?
I told you. Why are we having trouble here? We've still got the patent system causing us enormous difficulties, and we need to fix it. We've still got a monopolist with $50 billion in cash he shouldn't have, trying to destroy all the work that all of us have done in order to eat the whole industry back again into his own hand. We've still got very serious problems created by laws all around the world that were enacted in the interests of technology we knew was nonsense. propping up business models we knew were dead that have put real innovators in actual jails. Well, you look at them. What put Sklyarov in jail? What put Jan Johansson and his father in the pokey? What did all that evil work in the whole of the last decade but a whole bunch of public policy that you should have been fighting with us on the basis that it controverted the fundamental principles that were making your friends rich? But you were busy saying politics doesn't matter, it's open source, no need to talk about freedom, and so you were on the other side. Okay. Right? That's how we lived, okay? That's where we are today. We carried your water, and what did you do?
So, does anybody else have any questions here for Evan?
Hi, Evan. So you talk a lot about diplomacy and having diplomatic agreements, and in what's, you know, labeled for better or worse as the Web 2.0 world, it seems like the cost of engagement for individuals and these you know, engaging software systems out there is trading information, right? Because we have to give up some of our information and essentially our privacy to get value back, however you want to perceive or label or characterize that value. And I appreciate your concern in the long haul about, you know, about information consolidation and all that. The question for me is not only how do individuals and individuals engage in some sort of diplomatic relationship where they actually have some leverage with software providers, but also other organizations and governments that might be interested in what we exchange with a third party under some kind of assumption of privacy or, you know, reasonable exchange for the value we get from the software they're providing.
That's exactly right. You used to have Fourth Amendment rights in the United States, which meant that if government wanted personal information about your operations, they needed to get a warrant after convincing a judge they had probable cause. Now they fill out a subpoena blank and send it to Google or EasyPass or whoever it is. I know federal prosecutors who would entirely agree that the constitutional landscape has completely shifted under them in the past decade. They no longer have to worry about the judicial restraints on what government is allowed to discover because they have a private surveillance system now functioning which they can subpoena at convenience. That's a deeply important problem for anybody who cares about constitutional freedom in the United States. Dealing with it means very carefully and with a great respect for the subtlety involved, and without any attempt to take away from people technological rights we gave them in work we did because we wanted to secure those rights for them, to withdraw from this very unfortunate problem of rights conflict that we now have. It's a problem which they all face with respect to regimes that nobody likes, such as the regime running China at the moment, and it's a problem they face with regimes that only 60% of the population dislike, such as those now currently occupying the power in some democratic governments around the world. The consequences are very severe for us. We're not going to get out of it by disrespecting the rights that we've spent 20 years carefully constructing, cherishing, and protecting against serious attack. But we are going to have some social charters and some ecological rules of the road, and we're going to have to combine to make those enforceable. Otherwise, we are going to wind up in this world, which Tim says maybe Web 2.0 is and maybe isn't, and maybe it's got a good side and maybe it doesn't, but I absolutely agree with you that the serious public policy consequences of all that centralized information in private hands that can be pushed around by governments is a uniquely serious difficulty for people in the 21st century who care about individual freedom.
And so part of that we then, as the companies who are managing to exercise their rights in a way to make money in this environment?
Sure, and they all have now got chief privacy officers who are subtle, thoughtful, conscientious, and serious people. And they all have investors who are rapacious widows and orphans who would steal candy from a baby in order to get more rich, right? And the question is, who's going to win, the rapacious widows and orphans who own the company or the chief privacy officer who has a salary? That's the fundamental governance difficulty in all of this. We could deal with it, including in technological ways, if we were as fully committed to the free software movement now as we were then, which is why I'm being a little grumpy this morning with people who moved out of the free software movement early and left some of the rest of us to do the heavy lifting.
Over here.
Yes, good morning. I'm really enjoying hearing you speak. Yes, good morning. I enjoy hearing you speak every chance I get. Although I will say to you this morning that your rhetoric this morning rings hollow to me, given the recent GPLv3's omission to handle some of the software as a service provisions. I was wondering if you could perhaps speak to the effect that those provisions would have had on some of the points that you make this morning.
You mean, had the third version of the GPL said that you have to release source code if you offer services using modified versions of GPL works?
Correct.
If the license had done that, it would, in my judgment, have fundamentally violated two very important freedoms with which I started: the freedom to run code without permission for any purpose, and the freedom to make private modifications and keep them to yourselves. The issue presented by the software as a service loophole, so-called, in GPL 3, is the issue presented by a conflict of rights problem, which is when lawyers become valuable. Lawyers who simply arrange to defeat rights in return for the protection of their clients' interests do work I'm not much interested in, which is why I don't do it. Lawyers who attempt to deal with the problems of conflict of rights to secure everybody's rights while producing net social benefit in the end do constructive work that I try to teach and encourage. GPL 3 presented an opportunity to get it wrong, and I'm glad that Mr. Stallman and the Free Software Foundation didn't take it. Had they gone the other route, they would have wound up with a license like another copyleft license called the Open Software License, which tries to draw that distinction in a different way, and which accordingly very much limits its uptake and limits its opportunity to protect users' rights. So we made some compromises. We tried to find a way to do the one thing that we thought needed doing, which was to allow people who want to experiment with licensing terms that prohibit service offering without return of source to have access to software in the GPL Commons, but access to that software so that they could build their applications without pulling that GPL software across a membrane barrier into a world in which it would begin to function to limit rather than increase people's rights. The consequence is the compatibility terms that exist in final GPL 3, which we architected at the beginning and then re-architected in order to meet very sensible and thoughtful objections raised, among other people, by the Linux kernel developers, who saw possible forms of conflict with their rights, even in our initial architectural premises. For which reason, in discussion draft 3, we went back and re-engineered that whole compatibility structure in a fashion which I now think achieves a short-term, that's say 10-year, optimum on this subject. We will now have an increased public debate and discussion, which my empty rhetoric this morning is designed to stimulate, to spur, or to goad. Yes, I'm expressing a partisan point of view here this morning, because my fundamental belief is that the conversation has gotten stalled. It is bogging down in a bunch of essentially commercial, essentially trivial concerns, and it is failing to come to grips with this essential problem. We gave ourselves a 10-year licensing opportunity to have this conversation in a careful, thoughtful, conscientious way, which means meeting this as a public policy concern, not an issue of licensing technicality. So, and in order to do that, we're going to have to talk about freedom and drop all this other stuff over on the side for a little while and go back to thinking about rights and responsibilities.
So let me just ask you, though, and you've talked about two central rights that you were trying to preserve. But if you look at Richard's four freedoms, one of them is the right to study the code.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay, we don't have that right to study Google's code because they can basically keep it private. You're saying that the world is no different, this is just, you know, a bump in the log, but the fact is we have a situation in which most of the applications used today are using GPL code, yet they are not required to release that code because of the decision you made, and I think it was the right decision, but I still see that as a fundamental change in the way the world is working. I mean,
Tim, can I follow that up too, because doesn't it also mean that it favors the centralization of software with these large providers And enables them then to protect their patents.
Sure, and if you did all your social thinking in a kind of isolated, unifactorial way, you'd weigh that too heavily and you'd get the wrong answer. You live in a society with a First Amendment, a right to know, and a right to publish. But the Supreme Court said in 1973, and nobody's ever doubted them since, that that doesn't mean that reporters have a right of access to private property in order to learn what the public wants to know. That's to say, we recognize there are conflicts of rights, and we have to have a more complicated and more subtle second-order thought system. Does that mean that there's a subsidy to private wrongdoing in the United States because corporate private property can be used to resist the press, which would otherwise teach the people what's going wrong? Yes. Absolutely. Would we be wise to eliminate the rules holding that our bedroom is a place that Fox needs permission in order to go first, in order to have a better informed populace that was more aware of what's going wrong these days? Probably not. In other words, this isn't a thing to be done by binary logic. When you find yourself in a situation of conflict of rights, and you're correct that we are there, the right to study and understand meets in conflict with the right to run and make private modifications, then you must go up another order in your analysis and you have to think about the thing as a conflict of rights problem. It will be harder to think about the thing as a conflict of rights problem if you're also busy interviewing people about when's the IPO and who's going to acquire you, which is the dust under your feet.
But you're missing, you're actually confirming my initial premise.
I felt sure that no matter what I did, I would confirm your initial premise, which is why I tried to figure out a way not to.
But seriously, though, you just said there is a conflict of rights. The premise is that I wanted to get you to address here is we are in a different world. The fact is it used to be that the rights to study and the right to see the code were aligned because of the architecture of the way software was distributed with the right to run, the right to use,
Tim, the first time I faced this question had to do with what amounted to a live hosting of a proprietarily optimized GCC, right. And I think I faced it in 1993 in October, about 6 weeks after I first went to work for Stallman. I don't see the sign that anything has changed.
I see the sign that you have now discovered. As opposed to an exception.
But we foresaw it when it was not an exception. We looked at it, we saw, oh, that's a serious and important problem. We're going to have it later.
And we urged you to talk about it,
and you took 10 years off, and the problem got worse. You made yourself rich, you made yourself famous, you put your name on everything, and meantime the problem got worse. Now you say,
You have no solution for it.
On the contrary, I just did the first absolutely essential thing that was necessary. I gave us 10 years of strategic time. And I came here to warn you that you must use this 10 years with a much less frivolous and market-oriented sensibility than you wasted the last 10 years. I just bought you enough time in GPL-3 to address this question like a grown-up. So the question is, are you ready?
Okay. All right. Thank you. I don't think you've really figured out what we need to address.
If I figured it out and told it to you in a point-by-point way, you'd say Stallman is behaving as an ideologue and a despot. So instead, I invited you to a conversation you've been ignoring.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.